This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, Bridging the Digital Divide. But first, Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times, is a classic guide for those who want to become social activists, veteran organizers, and for that matter, anyone seeking to make a difference. Paul Loeb's book has been an inspiration for thousands of people. He's also the founder of the Campus Election Engagement Project. That's a national nonpartisan project that helps America's colleges and universities motivate their students to register, volunteer in campaigns, educate themselves, and turn out at the polls. Paul Loeb will be speaking at the University of Dayton on October 27th, and he joins us to discuss his work and what it takes to be an engaged, active citizen. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here.
Paul, tell us about what motivated you to write Soul of a Citizen.
Well, it was interesting. And then this is the earliest edition, which is now, gosh, 15 years and 170,000 copies ago. And I'd written three other books at that point, and they're all on different facets of social engagement or withdrawal. So I did a book on nuclear weapons workers. It was the height of the Cold War and kind of a metaphor for how all of us kind of avoid the sort of difficult and challenging lots of echoes to climate change these days. Did a book on grassroots peace activists, did a book on the values of of American students, the now the so-called Gen X. And then basically actually a friend of mine said, I was giving a book talk and he said, you have such great conversations afterwards with the audience and everybody's asking you, what does it take to get involved and what are the barriers and how do you get past them and what if you kind of wrote up all you know because you know quite a bit. And I thought about it, I thought, well, that's not a bad idea. And so I kind of pulled it together based on sort of everything that I'd learned over my writing, my research, my own engagement in different citizen movements, to sort of give people a guide, in a sense. And I don't think I had any anticipation of how it would end up taking off. I mean, I hope it would do okay. But people have just, essentially I tell stories and I kind of reflect on the lessons and lay out some sort of basic thoughts on just how people can live a life dealing with the really hard issues of the world. And it seemed to really hit a nerve, and, in a couple of editions later, it's now, it just continues to roll along. So that's pretty gratifying to me.
How did you get started in activism?
I got started during Vietnam, as a lot of folks of that generation did. I was initially, my first public debate was in seventh grade, 1964, and the cliche of the time was, if we don't stop them in Vietnam, they'll be on the beaches of California tomorrow. And I was growing up in California, and so I said, we got to stop them, stop the communists. I didn't think I knew what a communist was at that point, but the mouthy seventh grader. And I remember my neighbor's daughter, who was sort of early peace activist, said, we have a tiger by the tail, and all the class, of course, agreed with me pretty much because that was where the sentiment was in 1964. And by a few years later, I'd read more, learned more. I'd changed the culture; it changed, and they started in high school and then later in college at Stanford. I ended up, really working hard to end that war, as lots and lots of other people did. And I think it gave me a sort of sense of the potential power of citizens' movements. It also gave me a sense of some of the traps that they can fall into, because certainly the movements of that time fell into plenty of them. And I think it really honestly did set me on my path.
What is the power of citizens' movements? How crucial is citizen engagement?
I think it's essential because, if you say, there's sort of two ways to look at it. One is, do we have serious problems in our country, in our cities, in our world? The main answer is obviously yes. Everything from climate change, which is something really that we haven't, I don't think we've dealt with anything comparable, the nuclear arms race is comparable in terms of the potential threat, but the solutions were significantly easier. So, you know, we're something where you really have to change and retool, as is beginning to happen, the entire industrial base of the planet, or else you have a world of just, you know, endless catastrophe. That's a serious challenge. I think, you know, you go through your cities and you look at just, you know, the areas of persistent poverty and not just the cities. You know, I mean, you read about the, just, you know, the increase in, you know, opiate addiction and early deaths in rural areas. So I don't think anybody can argue that we don't have problems. And so the question is then, well, who's going to deal with them? And you can say, well, our political leaders, they're the ones we elect to do that, and we certainly hope they will. But to me, and I look at this time and again, if you want to have political leaders address issues, you have to basically pressure them, and you have to open up space for them to take risks that they might want to take but don't think they can get away with. And you have to pressure them maybe to do things that they might not want to do. So, you know, I look at it and it's everything from, you know, the labor movement and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the civil rights movement pushing Lyndon Baines Johnson, you know, from the conservative side, the organization of first, you know, the more majority Christian coalition on issues like abortion, and then later the Tea Party on, you know, the issues that they're salient. Under the Obama administration, I see, well, you know, again, the Tea Party, but I also see from the other side, you know, examples like the Keystone Pipeline, where it was an absolute done deal, and everybody knew it was going to go through. And I remember, I write about this in my book, The Impossible Take, a little while. A friend of mine lived in Nebraska where the pipeline was going to go through, and she's like, well, you know, this is, you know, there's really, we know we're going to lose. Every institution of power is lined up supporting it. But we're going to try. And so she did something really radical and held a potluck, got 3 or 4 people to participate. Then, you know, they bring in some others. They bring some, you know, organizations, Sierra Club, whatnot. They get a Rock Ridge Republican rancher named Randy Thompson to be kind of the face of the campaign, because the pipeline's going by his land, and he says, you know, I will not be bullied. And they do these life-size cutouts of Randy, and they say, we'll stand with Randy, kind of as a symbol, because, you know, Nebraska is a conservative state, and having a, you know, conservative Republican rancher as your face is a good idea. And then, you know, they're organizing, and the pipeline, TransCanada, the company had basically bought up every piece of media. They'd gone to all the local officials all along the way and said things like, oh, you know, we might want to store some equipment in, you know, your front yard, back porch, spare closet. Can we give you some outrageous sum of money for an option? So, you know, technically not a bribe, but functionally a bribe. You know, this is what they're up against. And then, you know, this momentum starts as, you know, they're having conversations around the state, starts shifting, and there is this key moment where the Cornhuskers football is kind of like religion there, and, you know, packed stadium, and TransCanada, of course, had bought an ad on the Jumbotron, and suddenly the stadium erupts into boos, which is not their anticipated reaction. And then, meanwhile, you've got, I think it was 1,100, 1,200 people arrested at the White House, many in Obama gear saying, you know, we've elected you, we want you to act on this. And, you know, after several rounds of deferring it, Obama basically cancels it. And you know, whether one agrees or not with the decision, I happen to think it's a good idea.
Well, Paul, it's interesting,
you know,
because
it's an example of citizens moving elected officials.
Well, it's kind of an example, too, of something you talk about in the book, which is that you can't expect change to happen all at once. It's a step-by-step thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, well, two ways. So one step-by-step that on the issues themselves. You know, I think Martin Luther King said, and I'm going to badly paraphrase, you know, you're never going to have a final victory. Victories are always, you know, a combination of sort of successive partial victories, sometimes setbacks, and that, you know, it's never going to be, you know, instant success. And then for step-by-step as well, for the people involved. So, you know, you do one thing, you do another, you do another, and then, you know, at a certain point, people look at you and say, oh, my gosh, you're a veteran activist. You know how to do this. I don't. But at the beginning, you're certainly tentative.
K. Can activism be bipartisan? Because I think you have a pretty good example concerning the internet and keeping it as an open access commons, where bipartisanship worked great in accomplishing that goal.
Well, I think when you can cross partisan lines, it's really powerful. And I mean, we do a little bit. You know, our campus election engagement project always encourages like young Dems and young R's to do joint registration drives on campus. It's not issue focused, but it's, you know, it's function focused to like say, okay, let's get both of you working together on this task, and then you can, you know, war it out afterwards for your respective candidates. And so this story, which I really like, is internet neutrality is one of these things that's incredibly important, but sounds kind of wonky and technical. So basically the deal is, does the carrier of your internet, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, do they have any right to control the content? You know, and you know, so the telephone, it's really clear. I'm talking to you through a phone line, and I can say whatever I want, and it's none of, I think, what am I with? I'm with CenturyLink, which used to be Quest. So I think it's a regional. You know, it's none of their it's none of their business what I say or don't say on the phone. I just pay my bill, and you know, and I'm allowed to do that. And that was how the internet launched. And then the big telecoms started essentially saying, well, you know, we ought to be able to control some of the content, and you know, they're masked in sort of bandwidth issues, but the real issue was the content. And at certain points, I mean, they really censored. So it was Merrill Pro-Choice America sent out a text alert, and Verizon blocked it because they didn't like the politics of Merrill Pro-Choice America. And Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam was doing a live live concert, and AT&T pulled the plug. So there were examples where basically they stepped in and sort of said, we have the right to actually affect content. And it was, this is about 10 years ago, it was going to be a done deal, and there was going to be a law in the Senate that would give them all of that power.
But you had these two vastly different groups stand up against it, didn't you?
Yeah, so then what happened is that there was a series of gatherings to bring people together across political lines. I got to attend one of them, was really fun. And at one of the other ones that I didn't attend, the head of Move On, which is a very liberal group, and Christian Coalition, quite conservative group, they met there, they got to be friends, they bonded over their kids. They had nothing in common politically, but you know, they liked each other and they talked on the phone afterwards. And then when this bill started coming through, the woman from Move On, Joan Blades, got the idea of basically that this was something that really affected everybody. And so she called Michelle Coom, who's a Christian Coalition person, and said, look, you know, this isn't about party. This is, you know, affects all of us. And they organized and brought in other folks. And so you had things like, I mean, Christian Coalition works a lot on issues. They're very anti-abortion, and they did a joint op-ed with the head of Planned Parenthood, which is obviously, you know, pro-abortion choice, you know, in the Washington Post, and Move On and Christian Coalition did a big ad in the New York Times saying, Move On and the Christian Coalition jointly agree that, and they brought in, they gathered signatures, and the thing about it was, they were each speaking, and they also brought in, you know, like Christian Coalition, I think they brought in Gun Owners of America. So the idea is that essentially, if they could control content, they could control it in any political direction, and they could censor anybody in any political direction. And this was a direct threat to democracy. And they gathered, it was the usual, a couple million signatures, whatever it was, that they delivered in mass on Capitol Hill. But the thing is these signatures were coming from radically different political places. So
how well did that work, Paul?
Pardon me?
How well did the whole thing work?
Well, it did. They basically blocked the bill and bought some time, and eventually Obama's FCC ruled in favor of net neutrality. And, I mean, it's still something that's contested. It's not, I mean, I'd love to see it enshrined in the law so a future president could reverse it. But right now, it's the law of the land. And they tweaked it a little bit and said, yeah, you know, if you're doing super streaming site, you can, you know, be charged a little bit more, which is fair. But the control of content no longer, you know, they can't control the content, which is as it should be. So yeah, it was a big victory. And again, you know, cross political lines, you know, as that Keystone to some degree was as well.
And Paul, we need to take a quick break here. We'll continue our conversation with Paul Loeb, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and my guest this afternoon, Paul Loeb, author of Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times. He's also the founder of the Campus Election Engagement Project. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Paul, what do you say to somebody who says, I'm just one person? What can I possibly do? What difference can I possibly make?
Well, you know, people say that, and I always think about it sort of like, so the rest of us, like, have, what, multiple personalities or something like that, you know? I don't know anybody who actually, you know, well, I guess what they did sheep cloning, I think, but, you know, they haven't done human cloning yet. And I much as I'd like to have a clone of myself, it's probably not a good idea.
It would be helpful at times, wouldn't it?
It would be helpful for all of us. I take the question seriously because people do say that all the time. I think what they really mean is, I feel powerless. I don't know how to act. I don't know how to take a stand. And one of the things, you know, with Soul of a Citizen and then my political hope anthology, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, I do is to sort of recognize that everybody who makes change has their own doubts and hesitations. There's a notion that I talk about in Soul called the perfect standard, which is the idea that you have to basically, you know, every single thing to be able to take a stand on an issue has to be the perfect issue. You have to be the combination of Albert Einstein, Gandhi, King, Wonder Woman, Susan B. Anthony, et cetera, et cetera. You know, just some standard nobody would ever meet. And then you actually get into the, you know, even the real giants of history, and basically people are, you know, they're hesitant, they're flawed. So I use the story Arun Gandhi's grandson of Gandhi told, of Gandhi's family mortgaging everything to basically send them to law school. And he gets out and he gets up in court and he's literally tongue-tied. He just stammers and stammers, can't get a word out, loses his case. Next case, the same thing happens. And they don't know what to do, because he's obviously going to do the equivalent of living in his mother's basement in, you know, for the rest of his life, be an utter failure. And they send him out to South Africa, and he literally, metaphorically, finds his public voice again in the struggle against apartheid. And the reason I love that story is that, you know, at that point he's so shy, he's so intimidated, and yet he becomes Gandhi. And so when somebody says, I'm only one person, what they really mean is, I'm someone who feels powerless. And if I indeed felt more powerful, then I could act. And my answer is invariably that you learn. It's not something that you just, you know, wake up with as you're born. And so I don't think people get that, partly because they don't know the history of citizen movements. You know, so in Soul of a Citizen, I open with a Rosa Parks story. And everybody, or at least 95% of people, think, oh, yeah, she just stepped out of nowhere onto this bus in Montgomery and instantly changed history, launched the civil rights movement, you know, et cetera. And it was, she'd been active for the civil rights movement for a dozen years with the NAACP. She was the secretary. She was doing the hard work of getting folks involved and getting them to come to meetings and all the things that built the base for people to respond. And you know, it was a very intentional strategic action. She just couldn't know how it would play out, but she certainly knew she was going to launch a campaign. Others were going to be part of it, and, you know, you'd see what happened. So I think the notion that we grow into involvement is really important.
What do you think has been the impact of social media? Of course, Rosa Parks didn't have that back in her day.
Right, none. I mean, the organizers boycott without, like, you know, no computers, no laptops, no cell phones.
Pretty amazing what they were able to accomplish. Yeah. What do you think about social media and how that's impacted citizen engagement and activism?
It's double-edged, because obviously there are these, you know, tools that are amazing. And, you know, you can launch something wherever you happen to be and, you know, end up communicating, if it hits a nerve, communicating with the world. That's very, very powerful. I mean, you know, I I should mention it, my website's soulofacitizen.org. It's, you know, people, you know, they can go, they can check out everything that I do. That's pretty cool. At the same time, I think it can be a trap. And the trap, I call it the seduction of clicking, is that you think everything can be done online. You know, you just, you know, give something enough Facebook likes and it'll happen. And it really can't. So, you know, I look right after Obama got in at the contrast between his supporters and his opponents. And his supporters were mostly online. You know, they'd signed petitions and letters to pass this bill or another that they supported. And his opponents were organized, the Tea Party were organizing on the ground, face-to-face, town meetings, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I don't think, whatever one's political view, I don't think there's even an argument as to which was more effective in the particular context. So you've got to do the face-to-face stuff, and you've got to make sure that the online stuff essentially serves it.
Let's talk about the campus election engagement project that you founded. Do you find that when you're working with students on college campuses that they have common concerns and causes, no matter what their party affiliation might be?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say that there's some areas that cross over. Certainly, most of them are concerned about the cost of education because it really has accelerated. I mean, you know, when I worked my way through school, in the early 70s, you know, 20 hours a week as a bartender, you know, I did that in New York City, which is an expensive city, paying private college tuition, and I ended up, you know, saving money working 20 hours a week. Right now, I mean, that would be unthinkable. At a public, in a less expensive city, that would be unthinkable. So I think they're concerned about that. It's interesting that they're also concerned about climate change, and that crosses political lines. And remember, there's a group called Blue Green Alliance brought together by the Sierra Club and United Steelworkers. I was at one of the conferences to sort of bring together labor and environmental issues, and they were in the same hotel as Conservative Political Action Commission conference, followed them back to back. And so I stuck around I had a late flight, to just talk to some of the folks there about climate change, and over 40, total denial, except for one person, I think, under 40, exactly the reverse. And I remember talking with a young woman who's reading head of her campus and Republicans, reading a book, How to Dismantle Obamacare. You know, so definitely a strong conservative. And I mentioned a young woman I'd profiled in Soul of a Citizen who created a coalition that on sustainability that extended as far as the campus, Young Republicans at Virginia Tech. And she said, well, that's awesome. I mean, that's wonderful. That's how it should be. Conservatives should be leading on this. And so I would say that on an issue like that, there's definitely an age division, and, you know, for folks who are younger, it's really much more of a salient issue, and it's much more an issue where they recognize the science. So, to me, that's heartening, because I would say it's an issue that shouldn't cross political lines. That people should deal with, whatever their politics, and maybe they'd have different solutions, but that it shouldn't be a partisan issue in terms of the existence of the threat.
How many campuses is the engagement project on now?
Well, we work, I don't actually have it exactly. In 2014, we worked with about 280, and I think it'll be roughly the same. I mean, our model is that we work through college administrators and faculty and student government and asking them to do basically nonpartisan approaches. Because, you know, college cannot and should not take a stand on a candidate. It'd be outrageous. But they can help people register to vote. They can have people navigate the voting laws that are very daunting. They can encourage them. We have nonpartisan candidate guides to just sort of look at what the stands are and debate them out. And, of course, to get out to the polls and vote. And so people want to check it out. It's campuselect.org, or just punch Campus Election Engagement Project into a search engine. And so essentially, schools work with us to varying degrees, and we at some schools we have fellows. So, like for instance, at the University of Cincinnati, they're actually co-sponsored with the Cincinnati League of Women Voters, or maybe it's a Southern, you know, it's a local League of Women Voters. I think it's, you know, whatever their official name is for the region, and they're helping support our fellows at University of Cincinnati, where we've got students who get $1,000 stipends to basically work with the administrators, faculty, student governments, and kind of carry things out on the ground. Our star example, she's now a Virginia director, but she was a student of Virginia Tech and her team registered 3,000 people, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
A couple of years ago. So, you know, so we have varying levels of engagement with the schools, from, you know, that level where we're really providing them, you know, somebody to actually carry it out, to schools that we may not have, you know, because our budgets are limited, you know, but we may not have the budget to do that, but at the same time, we'll send them material, resources, posters on voting laws, the nonpartisan candidate guides, you know, everything that they need to get their students engaged, and they'll often take it and run with it. I mean, I remember a Catholic school in Wisconsin. I was asking whether they'd voted. This is right after 2012, and they're like, oh, yes, we all did. And I was really amazed because, like, usually you just get a real drop-off, and almost this entire group had. And I said, well, what made the difference? And they started talking about our nonpartisan candidate guides and how the school had guides in every mailbox that just sort of described where candidates stood. And the prof said, yeah, those are your guides, Paul. You Center in Wisconsin Campus Compact was our partner organization that just does service learning, and they sent them to the schools, and we just thought this was a really great resource, so we printed 4,000 copies. And those are the kinds of things that we do. And, you know, from everything we can tell, it really does make a significant difference in participation rates, because we sort of systematically target the barriers to participation of the students, and you know, do it all in a nonpartisan way, and, you know, the schools end up being grateful, and the students end up, I mean, there's a lot of data that says if you vote when you're young, you're more likely to continue. That's basically how you end up getting them to participate, is just, you know, addressing the barriers.
So tell me what future you see for activism and engagement.
I'm sorry, say that last time.
What future do you see for activism and engagement?
Future.
Yeah, what do you see out there?
You know, I'm not a very good soothsayer, but I would say that I think, well, in any society it's critical. I mean, again, if you have citizens passive, even if you've got good leaders, it's problematic, and if you've got bad leaders, it's really problematic. So the citizens, I mean, it's complementary. You know, it's our job to raise issues, to look at issues, to understand how issues affect communities. And, you know, we're certainly not going to all agree on those issues. I mean, citizen movements come from all political perspectives. But to, you know, engage, you know, I hope to, I would say, you know, relatively civilly, engage, you know, in that process. And to basically keep raising those issues that need to be dealt with, put them on the public agenda, get each other, you know, get ordinary people talking about them, and recognize that, you know, in a democracy, I mean, this is maybe a core, you know, lesson of Solve a Citizen. In democracy, you know, we are the democracy to some degree. And if you simply hand it off, then you really don't have a very functioning, you know, democracy. You have a society that's kind of running by default. So, you know, I hope that, you know, you want to learn the lessons of the past, you know, including the traps to stay away from. You want to be able to reach out across political lines, because that's always very powerful. You want to tell your stories as well and effectively and, of course, accurately as you can, because that matters. And, you know, when you do that, that's how change occurs.
Paul, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Paul Loeb, author of Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times. He is also the founder of the Campus Election Engagement Project. He'll be at the University of Dayton on Thursday, October 27th as part of the UD Speaker Series. His presentation is going to take place at 7:30 p.m. in the Kennedy Union Ballroom with a book signing to follow. You can find a link to more information at WVXU.org. Coming up, we'll discuss the digital divide and how to bridge it. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.